Good evening. Welcome to the Critical Hour. I'm coming to you from the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., here on Radio Sputnik. I'm political scientist. I'm your host, political scientist and author and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next 2 hours, I'm going to explore and analyze a salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. America is in the clutches of a pandemic, of a recession, and we're looking at possibly 30 to 40 million people facing eviction. In the midst of all of this chaos, the Democrats and the Republicans can't find common ground to provide relief and economic stimulus for the American people and the American economy. For insight into this, we turn to our first guest. He's a man with a PhD in political economy, professor of economics at St. Mary's College, and author of The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. And his latest piece is entitled, A New Technology That Will Exponentially Expand Government Spying on Citizens. You can find that at jackrasmus.com. He is Dr. Jack Rasmus. As always, Jack, welcome back.
Glad to join you.
So Senate Majority Leader McConnell, he rejected this bipartisan stimulus package yesterday after months of basic inaction on trying to get a grip on the economic damage that has wreaked havoc on this economy. Your thoughts on where we are right now and the skinny package that McConnell is offering, which really seems to be more of a benefit towards business and providing very little, if any, relief, let alone stimulus for the economy?
It's absolutely no stimulus and relief very little for those who need it the most, the unemployed, renters facing eviction, so forth. You got to understand that his proposal is the same proposal he had back in June. This is like 7 months now, and he's refused to budge on any negotiation. His package has always been $500 billion. That's it. No more than that. And he's been the gray eminence, you might say, behind the scenes here for 7 months, playing a hard cop, soft cop with Trump administration to block any kind of stimulus whatsoever, unless it's on his terms and it's minimalist. And if the Democrats fall for the minimalist $322 billion or $500 billion, that's what's going on now with his faction there in the Senate, then that's it. And there won't be enough after January 20th to do anything for the economy. And, you know, even now, J.P. Morgan, Chase Bank and others are saying we're going to be slipping into a double dip first quarter of next year because of the situation. And that will be it. And the Democrats know that. Pelosi knows that. So if they agree to this minimalist package here of you know, McConnell's, then the game is over. But they're being pressured and have been, they being Pelosi, Schumer, for quite some time. Now, I understand Schumer sent a letter here, contents not disclosed, to McConnell. McConnell is the block. He has the block, the source here of the problem for 7 months. He's as cold-hearted politician as you could ever imagine, and he's not going to agree to anything more. His proposal provides only minimal partial unemployment benefits for another 30 days. In other words, till January 20th, whereas the bipartisan group in the Senate trying to get together, led by Romney, is proposing more that will provide funding through March. McConnell will never agree to that, never. And all this argument about, Biden has such good relationships with the Republican senators and he knows McConnell and all that, candy, you know, political candy, is nonsense, because McConnell is going to do what McConnell has always done, and that is try to make the Democrats look bad by not giving them what resources they need. And by the way, listeners should understand, the $500 billion that McConnell is proposing and Rand
was already there.
was already there. This is the $455 billion that under the CARES Act, the Treasury gave to the Federal Reserve, and they're just taking it back here next week. You know, timing is interesting, isn't it, right? $455 billion that the Fed hasn't spent on medium and large businesses and financial markets that didn't need it. They're taking that money back. They're shuffling it around, and they're going to use it to give it back to the Democrats if they want to fall for it. In other words, they're giving them what they've already gotten. They've already negotiated last March in the CARES Act. They're going to give it to them again, you see? That's what this game is all about. But more fundamentally, it's about, they don't really care about the unemployed and those losing their rents, and a student's going to have to double up on their forbearance, on their student debt here come January 1st, and workers who got a payroll deduction deferral here are going to have to double up and pay twice. They don't care about that. All they care about is the politics of the situation, and they're all looking at Georgia, you see? And, of course, if the Democrats win both seats in Georgia, which I think is highly unlikely, then they will be able to do more. But I don't think it's going to happen. And, McConnell is not going to spend a penny more than what's already been spent and given back by the Treasury until he sees what happens in Georgia on January 5th.
Well, that just answered one of my next questions. But to the bigger point, and this, I guess, is just my naivete, we're now outside of Georgia. We're 2 years away from the next election. How can either party declare win by holding the welfare of the American people hostage? I understand McConnell's thinking. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. But it still makes no political sense to me in the long run how causing more suffering can be considered a win.
Well, politics is not about suffering. Politics is about winning. And, McConnell and the Republicans with 70 million people in their pocket are banking on is that they'll be able to blame Biden and the Democrats and Pelosi for whatever failures come over the next 2 years. And they'll be able to take back the paper thin margin the Democrats have in the House. That's what it's all about. And that's what it's been about for 10 years. You know, McConnell has blocked Obama's programs for quite some time for, most of six of the eight years he was in office there. And it worked. So I'm sure they with even a closer margin here between the parties in Congress, they believe that it'll work again. I'm sure.
But here's the thing, Jack, that I have come to understand over the years, and I know you got a few more years than I do, is the country isn't nearly as conservative as the Republicans wanted to be, and it's not as liberal as the Democrats or the progressives wanted to be. And I'm thinking back on Newt Gingrich's Contract on America, which the Republicans oversold. They overplayed their hand, and they paid for it. And I think that they could be setting themselves up for a very similar outcome, because the 70 million or 72 million people that voted for Trump, those folks need jobs too. Those folks need health care as well. And this blame game will only work for so long, in my humble opinion. And I think McConnell could be overplaying his hand here.
Well, you may be right, but I don't think you are. Newt Gingrich, when he took over in the mid-90s and brought his precursors to the Tea Party and the Trump, mm-hmm. Trump public into Congress there, he had one strategy, and he said it publicly. He said, my strategy is to create a dysfunctional government. You believe it? Yeah, that's what the whole thing was mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. Government looked like it could not deliver, and he believed that the right wing would benefit from that. And mm-hmm. by God, you look at the last 25 years, and it has. They've been able to convince people through various means and through manipulating, you know, the gerrymandering and voter suppression and everything, and Breitbart and, you know, the bloggers, right-wing blogosphere and the whole thing, Tea Party, et cetera, all coalesce here under Trump. And they've been able to convince people that the problems are
too much government.
Too much government, right.
And so, too much government and social spending. Those are social program spending. That's the bane of our existence.
Not too much government for tax cuts for corporations and investment in the stock market. Not that government, you see.
Black Friday wasn't Black Friday this past weekend. Fewer Americans shopped, and those who did spent less. Before we get to your piece, and we got just a couple of minutes, the impact of a softer Black Friday.
Yeah, well, the stats are in, and it's down 14% from the previous year, you know? And they say, oh, that's because people went out and bought earlier because of the COVID, you know, in October. Well, you know, retail sales fell almost to zero in October, you know? They're falling further now. And that's because people are losing their income. You know, people, a million a week, are falling off of unemployment benefit insurance. And jobs, you know, are not you know, declining again, job growth. It's not surprising. It's not surprising that people are not buying. Consumption is not buying. Business and manufacturing is up a little bit. That's because they're building up their inventories, because inventories collapsed during the summer. It's not real expansion going on. And what about construction? Well, it's only residential housing and medium and high-end housing. There's not much medium and low-end housing, and there's no apartment building, and there's virtually no commercial construction. That's all we got, you see, and some services that rebounded when they opened up, but now they're closing down again. The forecast here is not all that great, and it's not surprising that retail sales and consumer spending are now flattening out once again. And that's why J.P. Morgan Chase says we're going to have a double dip next year.
And see, it's that double dip that will be an indication to me that what Mitch McConnell and the others see as being their upside to this game, I think the bottom is going to fall out, and they're going to fall out with it. Let's do this. Your piece, A New Technology That Will Exponentially Expand Government Spying on Citizens. If you would please, let me bring you back on Friday, and we can talk about this, because we're up against the clock here.
Sure. No problem.
Folks, A New Technology That Will Exponentially Expand Government Spying on Citizens. Go to jackrasmus.com. Go to jackrasmus.com. Read it so that you'll be ready for the conversation on Friday. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, thank you so much. Look forward to having you back.
Glad to join you.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. President-elect Biden promised America a diverse cabinet. I'd say diversity in gender or ethnicity is not as relevant as diversity in ideology and agenda. Don't get fooled by identity, gender, politics, or this diversity veneer. Seven civil rights groups want a meeting with President-elect Biden. The agenda, appointing Black officials in top roles, not lower ranking roles, is their agenda. What are we to make of this? For insight, we turn to our next guest. She's the president and founder of Transformative Justice Coalition. She's internationally renowned for contributions on critical justice issues, including the passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1991 and 2000, and the 2006 reauthorization of provisions of the Voting Rights Act. She joins us from Georgia, where she is directly involved in the January 5th runoff election for both Senate seats from Georgia, which we'll get to in a minute. She's attorney Barbara Arnwine. As always, Barbara, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
So, Barbara, there seems to be competing narratives here. The Washington Post has an article, civil rights groups aren't happy, as I just articulated. And then they have an article with a headline, Biden is building a team that looks like the people it serves. If that's true, I'm concerned about who he's serving. So let's start with the civil rights group perspective. Representatives from seven of the country's leading civil rights organizations are pressing to meet with President-elect Biden in coming days, escalating pressure on him to appoint Black nominees to the remaining high-profile cabinet posts amid concerns that white nominees have dominated this so far. Your thoughts on this dispute, Barbara Arnwine?
Well, actually, my first thought is that the group should not have to be writing and seeking the meeting. You would have thought the camp that Biden's camp would have reached out to them and would have said, we need you. We need to get your perspective. We want to make sure that we are doing everything we can to respect that African-American vote that went through everything in order to make sure that they were heard and they chose the president-elect and the vice president-elect. There is no way you can get around it. It was Black votes that made all the difference and, of course, Latino votes. And I want to give a shout-out to the Navajo Nation in Arizona that gave 97% of their votes to the Biden-Harris ticket. I'm just talking about what people did because, as you know, I'm a nonpartisan organization.
Barbara, especially when these meetings are now Zoom calls. So if you can have eight people on a Zoom call, you can have 28 people on a Zoom call.
Absolutely. And why would not the campaign have made that a first priority to reach out to the Black groups to have that meeting? We should not have to be on, you know, the press trying to bring pressure to have a meeting. That's the last thing I would have expected out of this administration. And I hope that they'll get it together because we should not have to be hearing this in the future.
But wait a minute, Barbara. Thank God that they are. I am incredibly impressed that organizations.
I'm glad like you are.
Oh yeah, exactly. I'm not saying you're not. I just wanna drive home the point that traditionally these organizations would be told, oh, don't go public. Oh, don't make this. Don't put this in the paper. Just be patient. Be patient. You'll get there. But they're saying, hell no, they're taking the bull by the horns. And this is the only way. This pressure is the only way you're going to get what you need. Continue, please.
And again, we shouldn't have to bring this pressure because they should have taken the initiative. They should have had the common darn sense, I'm sorry, make sure that they reached out to these groups. So the first thing is that, you know, that we expect more. You know, he said that he was going to have our backs, that he was going to have Black. He said he knows that the Black community put him there and that he was going to have the Black community backs. Well, you don't have our back by putting us at the back of the line. You know,
and Kamala Harris, where are you?
Yes.
Where are you?
She has to speak up because we are expecting more. I'm happy to see the appointment to the United Nations, but since then I've been looking hard, and I was very disappointed on the communications front because I expected, you know, I really had hoped that the press secretary was going to be a African-American. I mean, Simone and all these others, they got the chops. It's not like you don't have highly qualified people.
But wait a minute. Simone was all up in my television during the campaign.
Tell me about it.
She was the face and the and also the other sister, the sister, the from Tareen. The Haitian sister.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Kareem Pierre,
Yeah, they were all up in my TV set.
Tell me about it. CNN,
Early
MSNBC, CBS,
campaign.
You name it. Yes.
And now they can't be the communications director. They can't be the spokesperson.
I was very unhappy about that. And I said, you know, don't be putting them in the vice president's ghetto. I don't like that. So there were some real issues, and I really expected more. And I'm waiting to watch. I mean, I'm not going to just wait. I'm glad that the groups are moving out. Remember the first rule, everybody, of any positional politic is that you're never stronger than when you start. And if you start weak, if you sit back and say, well, I'm going to, you know, hope that he's going to do the right thing. No, that you have to be out there hard at the beginning, making the demand, demanding the justice, because Black folks went through hell. Literally, I'm in the city where they stood. I'm in Atlanta right now, where people stood in line for 16 hours to vote. Did you hear me? Black folks stood in line for 16 hours to vote. And we expect more than a token gesture. We expect people, Black people in several positions in the cabinet at the highest levels and in power. I want to see a Black AG. Where's the Attorney General? I want to see a Black, they gave away the Treasury. Okay. Well, you know, I want to see some Blacks in other powers, you know, defense. I want to see education. I want to see, health and human services. I want to see, you name it, Department of Transportation. I want to see some power. I don't want to see no backroom throwaway positions. I want to see Blacks, and I want to see people at that White House and power, over the domestic policy council, all right. The rest of this. And that's where we belong.
And quickly, because your time is very short, and I don't want this to get away, but I got to go back to my point in the opening. Diversity in gender or ethnicity is not as relevant as diversity in ideology and agenda. So don't bring me the go-alongs to get-alongs that we've been stuck with, that got us into Libya, that got us into Syria, that got us, that tried to overthrow Maduro in Venezuela. We don't need those Black people. We need folks that are actually progressive. But now to the battling agenda here or tone. The Washington Post comes out with this article that Biden is building a team that looks like the people it serves. If that's true, I don't like who he's serving.
Well, I think, you know, they're obviously talking about white women, because it's clear that, you know, the white women have been a tremendous beneficiary so far of these appointments. And there should, you know, clearly be, you know, women getting a lot of appointments, but I also want to make sure that women of color, Black women, are being centered, because we should be at the center. And I mean center of determining policy, not executing it, but determining it at the center of making sure that everything that's done is thinking about our communities. And that worries me deeply, what I'm seeing. And I'm so glad that these groups have done what they've done, and I support them 100%.
Policy doesn't make itself. Policy is made by people, and that's what we have to pay attention to. For example, Neera Tanden, he's touting her South Asian heritage, and he says, she believes what I believe, that a budget should reflect our values. But she's also the person who believes that social programs should be cut. She's also the person that believes that Social Security should be cut. So don't send me some Trojan horse with a lovely smile and a soft tone and a very sharp blade. That's not what it is that we voted for. And that, I believe, needs to be very clear. I want to take the rest of the time to give you the time. You are in Georgia. You're dealing with this runoff in January. Why are you there? I want to say, what was it, 198,000 Black names were taken off the roll in Georgia? Go ahead.
Well, they took off the rolls 300,000 people, of which we have established that 198,000 were wrongfully removed. that they never should have been taken off the list. Because frankly, remember, the only reason why you ever take somebody off the voter registration list is because you think they moved and did not indicate that they moved and did not remove themselves off the list. Or that they died, or
which
some
is
other
the permanent
reason
move.
That they're no longer eligible, or they're in jail, or whatever. But the bottom line is that they took these people off because, Wilmer, they used the wrong process. They violated the National Voter Registration Act by using a non-sanctioned, approved USPS licensee. That's what's required. It's got to be an approved one, and they used a non-approved one, so they got a bad list. And as a result of getting the bad list, they took people off who are living right now in the same addresses where they originally registered. They never moved, and they were wrongfully removed. And so we're saying put them back on. You know, if you made a mistake, correct your mistake instead of just sitting around stubbornly refusing to do anything when you know you made a mistake and when you know you violated the law. So unfortunately, even though they were warned and even though we wrote them and asked them to do something about it, they did nothing. So now we're saying, well, you know, the courts are going to have to make you do the right thing. So that's why we filed an action in U.S. District Court here in the Atlanta Division, requesting that there be an immediate injunction issued, an affirmative injunction to restore these people to the voting rolls.
And it's important to understand the contradiction now that that Trump is coming out after Governor Kemp. He's coming out after Raffensperger, the Secretary of State. These guys did everything they could do in their minds legally to operate on the margins to create a database as advantageous to Trump as possible. It just got overwhelmed by turnout.
Well, the bottom line is that just because you, you know, believe in counting every vote does not indicate that you don't believe in blocking as many votes as you can from ever being cast. And that's what this whole lawsuit is about, because the removal of these people from the rolls means that they never got the vote. They never had the right to vote. And so so it wasn't about the counting of the ballots. It was the fact that they never were included at all in the ability of people who were able to go to the polls, get a ballot, and cast it. They never had that right. So we're saying restore that right immediately. Do what's necessary under the law to comply with the law and to make sure that every voter in Georgia is accorded their right to vote. We have so much more we could talk about, but we'll do that in the future because about to put out another press statement about Georgia because they're about to do some more voter suppression.
Thank you, Barbara. We'll bring you back.
Fighting.
We will bring you back.
So
really appreciate it.
Right.
Folks, Barbara Arnwine, keep up the fight. Thank you so much. Be safe.
You.
We look forward to having you back.
Alrighty, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, dear. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, COVID marches on. Here are the numbers, the latest numbers for cases and deaths in the United States. There are now 13.8 million total cases, up by 184,000 cases from yesterday. And there are, unfortunately, now 271,000 deaths, up by 2,607 from Tuesday yesterday. as I said with Dr. Yolandra Hancock yesterday, there's no national testing strategy for the COVID virus that ever came out from the federal government, nor was there a nationally led strategy for the procurement of PPE, protective equipment. States were basically cast to the wind to buy supplies on their own. But yesterday, a little known federal advisory committee met and provided some of the direction for the upcoming vaccination process, this 10 months after the first case of COVID-19 was reported in the United States. What are we to make of all of this? And what are we to make of these recommendations? Well, for insight, we turn to our next guest. She has committed her life to holistic healthcare and serving the community. She's an internal medicine specialist in the Division of General Internal Medicine at George Washington University Hospital. She's a graduate of the University of Michigan Medical School, specializing in internal medicine. She's been rated one of the top doctors in Washington, D.C., more times than I have fingers and toes. She is also the executive director of the Rodham, well, a little exaggeration, but she's a hell of a doctor. One of the executive, she's the executive director of the Rodham Institute, Dr. Gigi L. Bayoumi. As always, Dr. Gigi, welcome back.
It is my absolute pleasure as always.
Thank you, ma'am. So yesterday, a CDC panel met and suggested first vaccinating healthcare workers and nursing home residents. As Mother Jones writes, as many as 40 million doses of two COVID-19 vaccines are expected to be available for distribution by the end of this month, enough to vaccinate 20 million people. But in a country of more than 330 million, who should be the first in line to get them? Talk to us about this quandary and basically the recommendations that came from this CDC panel yesterday.
Sure. Well, I mean, you want to make sure that your healthcare workforce is healthy. And so that makes sense that the people caring for others would be first in line. You can't vaccinate everybody all at once because about 5 to 10% of people, at least in the studies of the vaccine, of which actually still have not seen them, the healthcare community, it's not been released publicly. But if we take things at their word, 5 to 10% of people have side effects, the same kinds of side effects that you get with the flu vaccine, the headaches or arm, maybe some muscle aches. So we don't want everybody to get their vaccines all at once because that could impact the number of people that can work just from the side effects from the COVID vaccine. But yes, that makes a lot of sense. And of course, the second tier would be the people that are most vulnerable people, the elderly people with the chronic medical conditions, and so forth. And that's how it's going to be rolled out. And that makes the most sense, both equitably and practically.
You mentioned side effects, and you mentioned side effects very early on in this conversation. And side effects is not something that has been readily discussed or articulated through mainstream media as we keep hearing discussion about COVID-19. Elaborate a little more on what you understand what some of the side effects may be and why taking that into account, unknown side effects, is important in terms of how the government or how the CDC decides how to proceed.
Yes. Well, first of all, before we get into that, I just want to say that trust has really been ruptured between the public and these government entities or institutions such as the CDC, which by and large, prior to the COVID crisis, had been trusted by the public, certainly by the healthcare community. So I'm going to sort of put a caveat in our discussion. It doesn't matter how good the vaccine is if nobody's going to take it and if people don't trust the process. Mm-hmm. So I think that the side effects, you know, when you ask people about taking the flu vaccine, many people will say, oh, I don't want to get the flu vaccine because I'll get the flu, which is not true. They've actually done many, many studies over the years. You get the side effects, because your body is mounting the response that will actually ultimately protect you from getting influenza. It's the same here, at least theoretically.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
I think to your point about the flu vaccine, does it make sense to quickly explain the difference between a live vaccine and a dead vaccine?
Sure. We don't really use live vaccines very much. The only ones that are live vaccines are yellow fever and oral polio vaccines.
What is a live vaccine?
A live vaccine means that you're actually taking a portion or the actual, like polio or yellow fever, and injecting some of it at a small dose to create a reaction, but you're not giving a lot so that the person doesn't come back or come down with the disease. So you're getting enough of an immune response to protect you from the disease. We don't use live vaccines by and large. All of the ones that we have are what we call inactivated vaccines, so that they don't have the potential to cause the illness. So all of the vaccines, whether it's influenza, pneumonia, or the shingles vaccines, are all inactivated. And that's important because those vaccines can safely be given to people who are immunocompromised. So if you have HIV or cancer, they can safely be given to pregnant women, to the elderly. So that's why it's important to make the distinction, is that there's...
What we're dealing with here in terms of the Moderna or the AstraZeneca, I thought I read that one of the reasons why they have to be kept so cold is because they're live vaccines. Is that wrong?
So I don't know about that. That's not my understanding.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that you are not correct. My understanding is that they are inactivated vaccines, or at least one of them is, to give enough options. But those are the kinds of things that will not affect vaccinations, because the good news is that you have more than one vaccine available. So that if a facility or if a community does not have the ability to deep freeze the vaccine, 100 degrees below freezing, then there's another alternative. So I think that that's a positive aspect of the vaccines. But I have to tell you that the numbers and the vetting of these vaccines have not been transparent. Mm-hmm. So in a way, we're kind of lucky here in the United States that Britain and France are actually leading sort of the real life vaccination programs with a lot more people, so that we'll get a better sense of how well tolerated these vaccines are outside of a clinical trial, more like in real life kind of use.
How confident are you with the lack of transparency that you just mentioned? How confident are you in the data that you've seen?
Well, we haven't seen the data. That's the whole problem. And so until it's vetted by the healthcare community, by infectious disease experts and others, I really reserve judgment. And, to me, the gold standard of confidence in any treatment or test or vaccination is, do I feel comfortable taking it myself? And advising that my family members take it. So right now, I can't say that. I'm anxious for there to be a safe and effective vaccine, because I think it's important, especially my elderly parents, to be protected. And, I, as a healthcare worker, and all the people that are vulnerable, particularly, to be protected. But today in December, early December, I cannot state that. Now, end of December, hopefully we will have more information. January, I hope that we'll have more information. But to be responsible and to give advice, I think I have to reserve judgment. I understand that the data will be released within the next few weeks or is being reviewed, and we should have an answer in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, there are so many motivations to get these vaccines out that are not usually traditional, and that is one is the profit motive and then the political motive. I mean, mm-hmm. vaccines in general are not very costly. You don't really make a lot of money on vaccines in general. Mm-hmm. That's why we have shortages for the flu vaccine, right? Because not many manufacturers want to make them. The COVID vaccinations, there's a lot of profit to be made. So we have to be very careful and vigilant, and we have to have many different groups really evaluate the data, including patient advocates and community members, so that it's a fair vetting.
So that I have a better understanding of the data, the expert advisors to the CDC, they voted yesterday 13-1 to recommend that healthcare workers and residents of long-term care facilities get top priority. As far as you know, was their vote based upon the data, but the data just hasn't been released publicly, or were they making their decisions based upon a different criteria?
That's a very good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I mean, okay. They do have the data that they are reviewing. Now, I would make that assumption, but again, you know, if you don't have things clearly outlined and shared mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. say, look, we've reviewed the data, okay? It's not released to the public yet. It's going to be mm-hmm. forthcoming in X time framework. And based on what we have seen, and we have experts from epidemiologists to infectious disease to community members, this is the conclusion that we made. And P.S., the dissenting vote was for these reasons. That's a very different process than, mm-hmm. look, these are the recommendations that we made. And until and unless we have that kind of transparency, trust is going to be a factor.
We have just about 2 minutes left. All of this discussion that we're having and the discussion that took place at the CDC yesterday is in the context of Dr. Fauci warning on Sunday that the worst was yet to come with the COVID-19 pandemic, with the United States potentially facing a, quote, surge superimposed upon the surge that we're already in, end quote, after the Thanksgiving holidays. Your thoughts to Dr. Fauci's very apocalyptic warning?
Yes. Well, we are already seeing it here in Washington, D.C. The cases are beginning to ramp up. I think that there are many reasons for this, not the least of which is everybody's gotten COVID fatigue, mask fatigue, which is certainly understandable. But the mixed messaging, the conspiracy theories that are coming out of the Trump administration have not helped. I also think that there has to be public health messaging which is more aggressive and not politicized. For example, they make masks as a choice, as a personal choice. Well, guess what? Wearing seatbelts are not a personal choice. This is required by law. Stopping at a red light is not a personal choice. We live in a society. We have to wear these as a matter of what's required of us as members of our society. So yes, and what Dr. Fauci also added to his statements is that it's still not too late to have mitigation efforts. So yes, he's predicting something negative, but it's never too late to make a change.
And thank you very much for that. As always, Dr. Gigi El-Bayoumi, greatly appreciate that analysis. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you. I'm always at your service. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, the president is vowing to veto the National Defense Authorization Act, the $740 billion NDA, unless it includes a measure eliminating a federal law protecting tech companies such as Twitter and Facebook. What's really at stake here? What are the motivations? And are these protections as important as the president is making them out to be? Well, for insight into this, we turn to our next guest. He's a web developer and technologist, Chris Garaffa. As always, Chris, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back with you. Thank you for having me again.
So the president tweets, quote, "If the very dangerous and unfair Section 230 is not completely terminated as part of the National Defense Authorization Act, I will be forced to unequivocally veto the bill when sent to the very beautiful Resolute desk." He tweeted this late yesterday. What is Section 230 and why is the president so stuck on this?
Sure. Section 230 comes from the 1996 Communications Decency Act. And really what it does is it sets up legal protections for online forums and other platforms that if you allow users of your site to publish content like comments on a blog post or Facebook posts or, Twitter posts, anything like that, the platform are not legally liable for the content that your users post. That's all that Section 230 really, really does. Trump and many of the Republicans, as well as many Democrats, fully misunderstand 230 and what it means and what removing Section 230 protections would actually do. Imagine if you went to post something on Facebook or Twitter and a message came up that said, we'll review your post with our legal team and post or review or get back to you within 5 to 7 business days. That would be the end of social media as we know it. Google, Facebook, Twitter, all of these other networks could be held legally accountable for what their users post. Now, that might not sound like such a bad idea in some cases, right? But it ultimately impacts our freedom of expression on the internet. It also impacts smaller websites. While Facebook and Twitter are the giant ones, any website that has comments or where you can submit a post, where you can guest blog, anything like that would actually be impacted by a repeal of Section 230. And it would not prevent Facebook or Twitter from putting these little tags, these little warning labels on some of the posts as they have been doing with Trump's, very clearly false posts about so-called election interference.
So help me understand this. When Facebook first came out, it was at least thought to be this benign, huge chat room where people just met, talked about stuff, exchanged ideas, and moved on. And so as such, to your point, you don't want to hold Facebook responsible. You want to allow as free of an exchange of ideas in the public square as you can possibly provide for. And you don't want organizations like Twitter and Facebook censoring what people post. But then we got into understanding the political power that these entities wield. And so as a result of the alleged interference in our elections by foreign operatives, some restraints were put on these organizations, right?
That's right.
So hence the tags that you're talking about, they had to start to become arbiters of the validity of the information being posted. So where does Section 230 fit into that part of the conversation? Or am I mixing apples and aardvarks?
No, I think they are separate but related. The claim that Trump is making is that by putting these labels on posts, both Facebook and Twitter, they're becoming publishers instead of platforms. And I think that is legally dubious. And that's the distinction, though, that Section 230 makes between a publisher and a platform.
And elaborate on that, please, so the audience can understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. So
because a publisher has more control over what is published, and with that control comes greater responsibility and obligation.
Correct. So the New York Times, for example, the Washington Post, if they publish, they are publishers, they have control over what is on their website or on their front page, and they have a certain legal responsibility with that content because they are the ones producing it. Facebook and Twitter, on the other hand, are, in this case, the way we're talking about it, they are platforms that allow us to post our thoughts and our own content. And the only thing that really is important here in that distinction is that we are saying that the individual user can be held legally liable for their content, not the platform that it's being posted on. So if you post something illegal, that could get you in legal trouble, you can still be held, legally responsible for it. And this happens very frequently. You still can't post illegal content on on Facebook or Twitter. They will take those things down. But if you post something that somebody else just doesn't like, for example, Donald Trump just doesn't like, then, you can't be, Facebook can't be held liable for that. They can't face legal penalties for your content. And they are not producing that content. They are not the publisher of it. These companies also do this in other ways. Now if you go to, if you post certain articles on Facebook that are clearly satire or that have been just shown to be absolutely false, like something from maybe The Onion or the Babylon Bee or other, other sources, it'll have a little tag and it'll say that. And, that's not the worst thing in the world. I think it's questionable in the long term for Facebook's policies, given how, Facebook likes to determine what is true or not. But that is not, that's not the kind of thing that differentiates a publisher from a platform.
I think also what's important for people to understand here is the whole idea of liability as it relates to financial penalty. If Chris Garafa defames me on Facebook and I want to sue Chris Garafa, I'm not only going to sue Chris Garafa for defamation, I'm going to sue every element or entity that is associated with the defamation. I'm going to look for the deepest pocket possible so that I can get as much money as possible. So Facebook and Twitter, they, as platforms, not publishers, they need to be protected from all of the frivolous lawsuits that they would be brought into if they didn't have this 230 protection. Is that right?
That's right. And, while we are, we are rightly focusing on the big platforms here because that's where a lot of the attention is. Of course, this is aimed primarily at Facebook and Twitter, but it's smaller platforms that are actually going to be hit the hardest in terms of, having to shut down. Like I mentioned earlier, just any website with comments on it, including news websites, people's personal blogs or chat forums that you can still find all over the internet, those will also be impacted. And if somebody's a fan of a band, and they just want to have a conversations on a forum about that band or the brand of car they like, all of the things that people use the internet for, it's going to be much harder to have open discussion and free discussion if platforms are going to be held liable for the content that their users post. Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, they all have, huge multi-billion dollar valuations. Joe's cooking blog certainly does not and won't have the capacity to moderate all of those comments.
So we know that the president has been railing against Twitter and other platforms for fact-checking him, for holding him accountable for the foolishness that he continues to put out there. Congressional aides and others are skeptical about whether the president would actually veto the legislation. He's been on this rant for quite a while. Your thoughts, is this just another one of his idle threats, or is there really some concern that the NDAA is in jeopardy?
No, this is just all hot air from Trump, but that doesn't mean I'm not concerned. You know, first of all, the state needs the NDAA, right? The establishment needs that military funding and guidance and regulation. It's going to pass whether it waits until January 20th or not. At the same time, Congress will have the votes almost guaranteed. This is a bipartisan bill and has been for decades now. Congress would be able to override a Trump veto on this, and I can almost guarantee that would happen. Republicans and Democrats, you know, they're arguing also over this issue of the military bases named for Confederate officers, but, you know, which certainly should be removed. I mean, we should also shut the bases down, frankly, and repurpose them. But, you know, ultimately, that debate is going to be settled one way or another. There's going to be some sort of compromise. This bill, the NDAA, unfortunately, frankly, will pass. And, you know, whether it's under Trump or early days of Biden, it will go to that, as Trump says, beautiful, resolute desk, and it will be signed. But I expect, actually, that Congress will just override a veto if it comes to that.
This is one issue facing platforms such as Twitter and Facebook, but just really quickly, are there some other things on the horizon that you're paying attention to that folks need to be aware of?
Yeah, absolutely. Really quickly, also related to Section 230, the Earn It Act of 2020, Eliminating Abusive and Rampant Neglect of Interactive Technologies Act, a bipartisan bill and co-sponsored by Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal. It passed the Senate. It is in the House, and it actually could give very serious and scary powers to the Attorney General to overthrow Section 230. I didn't want Bill Barr to have that power. I don't want Joe Biden's Attorney General to have that power either.
And that give that one again, please.
That is the Earn It Act of 2020.
The Earn It Act of 2020. So people need to pull the coattails of their House representatives about the Earn It Act of 2020. Chris Garaffa, as always, sir, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your analysis, and we look forward to having you back.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's still another hour. Can you believe it? There's another hour of this show on the other side. You want to stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The Boeing 737 MAX has returned to the skies with the media on board. Boeing's 737 MAX, it took off today on its first public appearance with media on board since being grounded after fatal crashes. As one of its largest customers, American Airlines, is seeking to prove that it is safe for passenger flight. What are we to make of this? Well, for insight, we turn to our next guest. He's a professor at SUNY Albany. He's the author of First Class Passengers on a Sinking Ship, Elite Politics and the Decline of Great Powers. Professor Richard Lachman, as always, welcome back.
Good to be with you again.
So when you first read the story that the 737 MAX is returning to the skies, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I wasn't surprised since the FAA had given approval for it to fly. And, you know, presumably they've done enough tests to determine that it, you know, now is safe in a way that it wasn't when they first approved it years ago.
The flight today was from Dallas, Texas to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and this flight is taking place weeks before what is scheduled to be the first commercial passenger flight on the 29th of this month. And it's part of a concerted public relations effort to restore customer faith in the airline, in the airliner, after its 20-month ban. Can they pull this one out? Your thoughts?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, the crashes and the investigations after revealed that, you know, Boeing had essentially abandoned any concern with building a safe plane and was just trying to produce the plane as quickly as it could to make as much profit as it could, and that the FAA had basically given over the job of testing and certifying planes to the manufacturer. So, you know, to have confidence in that plane will require the believing that there's been a drastic change in the behavior of both Boeing and the FAA. And I'm not sure if the public's going to believe that. On the other hand, when you book a flight, you even if you can see what plane you're going to be flying on, airlines change that all the time. And, you know, so it may very well be that people show up at the airport. It turns out that they're told to get on a 737 MAX. And at that point, they'll say, well, I've made my plans. I'm here at the airport. I'll just go ahead and hope it's all right. And if it flies and there aren't crashes, I think many people will once again have confidence.
You know, I remember before the plane was grounded, one of the to your point, one of the problems that the airlines were having was people started asking, are you putting me on a 737? And people in the airlines would say, yeah. And people said, no, give me another flight. And that, you know, that was one of the things that one of the many things that contributed to the airlines or the FAA finally having to or deciding to ground the plane. I had a pilot text me saying that it's not going to be easy for pilots and it's going to take some skill for them to master flying this plane, that all pilots have to complete and pass a FAA simulator program. And it's a 2 to 4 hours that the FAA is going to be managing, and that the FAA will be riding on actual flights in the beginning to reintroduce it back into the line. American will fly employees on it to get confidence up, and that Houston and Denver will fly it in February schedules for United Airlines. COVID restricting airline travel, and it'll be very interesting to see as people start going back to the airports, particularly once the vaccine starts to be introduced and people start to regain their confidence. It'll be very interesting to see how quickly Boeing can get confidence in this plane, how quickly the airlines can convince their passengers that this plane is viable. Because also, I think Boeing has implemented a 24-hour customer
hotline.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. Because they want to do everything in their power to address any type of problem that is even perceived with this thing. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, certainly it's essential for Boeing's financial survival to convince people the plane is safe, because this is so much of their business. And, you know, I think they probably will eventually be able to do that. I mean, they're, you know, people buy hamburgers from drive-up, you know, fast food places, even though there are repeated cases where customers get poisoned, sickened, and in some cases die from tainted meat. So, you know, people tend to get over these sorts of disasters fairly quickly. And, you know, in any case, you know, even the previous, you know, unsafe 737 MAX was still safer than the trip to and from the airport in a car. So, you know, when you have a crash, and 100-plus people are killed, you know, it's frightening because it's such a spectacular event. But, you know, planes, you know, even the less safe planes are still the safest mode of travel.
What about the European market versus the American market? Because, again, when you go back to after the Indonesian crashes and you look at where a lot of the pushback came from, it was European countries saying, we're not going to allow this plane into our airspace. And so there were a number of factors that wound up putting pressure on the FAA and putting pressure on Boeing to ground the plane. And one of the things was European countries and Asian countries saying, we're not letting this thing into our airspace. So do you see any issues as it relates to whether it's a cultural issue or cultural difference in terms of how Europeans view these things versus Americans? Do you see any of those factors playing into this?
I mean, it's, I think, mainly economic competition. You know, they're two Airbus. Big airplane manufacturers in the world, you know, Boeing in the U.S. and Airbus in Europe. And European airlines mainly buy Airbuses, and American airlines mainly buy Boeings. And, you know, on each side, if they have an opportunity to undermine the rival company, they'll do it. But in the end, the sales, you know, aren't in the U.S. or Europe. They're in Asia, and what the Asian airlines do is going to be decisive. So Boeing's biggest job is to convince the Asian airlines that the plane is safe. And in order to do that, they, of course, also have to convince passengers in Asia that the plane is safe.
It'll be very interesting knowing how quickly China adapts, particularly when it comes to technology. It'll be very interesting to me to see if in 2 to 3 years, China has a plane to rival, particularly if they see that the MAX 737 doesn't regain the market share that it had, because it was Boeing's, I think, best-selling and most profitable airliner. It would be very interesting to me to see if China all of a sudden comes up with a plane to rival this thing, because, again, we know how quickly, particularly as it relates to technology, that the Chinese engineers can adapt.
Well, I mean, they're already working on it. They were working on it before the problems with the 737 MAX. And, you know, the reports are that within a couple of years, they will be manufacturing a major passenger airplane. And the Chinese market itself is big enough that even if they only sell in China, it's a viable business.
Exactly. Wow. Well, we'll have to see. Again, they set up this 24-hour call center. And, I mean, they're really, really going full bore here, trying to be sure that they've dotted every I, that they've crossed every T. But as this pilot wrote to me talking about training was also, not only was it the technical problem that was obvious, but being properly trained on how to deal with the problem was a huge contributor to this as well. And so it'll be interesting to see if we start to hear rumblings from pilots that the training was insufficient.
Yeah, and that could be. And that was a big part of the original problem, as you mentioned, that, you know, Boeing felt that if they admitted that the 737 MAX is different from the earlier 737, as in fact it was, then the FAA would have required pilots to go through training. That would have been an expense for airlines, and they might have been less likely to buy the plane. So Boeing lied about the extent of the differences and in that way convinced the FAA not to mandate the extra training. Well, now there will be the extra training, and we'll see if it's enough.
We will see. Time will tell, and hopefully it won't take lives to make that determination. Professor Richard Lachman, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate that insight. We look forward to having you back.
Good to talk with you.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. China's Chang'e-5 lands on the moon to retrieve samples. The Chang'e-5 spacecraft successfully landed on the near side of the moon late Tuesday and sent back images. This is according to the China National Space Administration. What are we to make of this latest technological success? And also, what impact is this having on the geopolitical landscape? We turn to our next guest. He's a peace activist, writer, and teacher, KJ No. KJ, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
So we touched on this yesterday, but the Chang'e-5 landed on the near side of the moon late yesterday. We talked about the success of being able to communicate from the far or dark side of the moon. Talk about the impact that this has from a technological perspective. And is this success one of the issues that is kind of underlying a lot of the geopolitical distress that the United States and Europe are having with China?
Absolutely. The first thing to point out is that it's a tour de force. It's a technological tour de force. It's quite extraordinary what they've done. About 2 kilograms of samples will be returned. So it's a lander and an ascender and returning vehicle. So it's very, very complex. And they landed it, you know, within inches of where they wanted to land it. So that all of this is technological proof of concept that they are a space and technological power. Now, the West sees these as emerging and disruptive technologies, disruptive in the sense that they disrupt Western technological superiority upon which its colonial and neo-imperial domination of the world is based on. So the fact that China can do this autonomously poses a great threat, and this is also part of why NATO has, come out and identified China as a threat and put forth measures to challenge it specifically in the domain of technology. But just going back, you know, the Chinese space program, the National Space Administration, is extraordinarily highly developed. They're the third country to send humans into space. By the end of 2022, they expect to have a manned space station, and they expect to send crewed expeditions to the moon. So once again, all of this challenges this notion of Western supremacy and Western dominance. And that's, again, the reason for this heightened rhetoric and information warfare.
What about those who would say, well, wait a minute now, the United States went to the moon in the 60s. And, you know, we've been to the moon, been there, done that, got the T-shirt. And so explain why China's now doing this, you know, 50 years later is such a technological advancement from what the United States did with the Gemini and Apollo missions.
Well, you know, the mission to the moon itself, that in and of itself is less important than the technological feats that involve the precision, the way that it goes, and the way that it samples. And remember, this is the first moon sampling mission in more than 40 years. The U.S. has essentially let that program just kind of atrophy. But all of these technologies are applicable and really are, again, proof of concept of missile control technologies that will also be employed in hypersonic gliding vehicles and other missiles. So,
to that point, what role does 5G play in all this?
It will all be connected, yes. So the difference between 5G and the current 3 and 4G is like the difference between your brainstem and your cerebral cortex. So it's just much more interconnected, much faster, mm-hmm. essentially more intelligent. And so all of these things work together. We're talking about big data, AI, 5G, and this aerospace technology. All of that will be coordinated, and it will give China a leading edge in, you know, industrial but also military development. And again, this is what the U.S. and the NATO consider to be emerging and disruptive technologies that they want to clip in the wing. And China is showing that this is not going to happen. We're going to forge ahead with our programs and show that we can do this.
And you're using the term a proof of concept is what prompted me to ask the 5G question, because now they've taken, I always talk to my students about the difference between the theoretical and the practical. And so they've taken the theoretical, the 5G technology and so on and so forth, and they have now made a practical application of it, and we find it on the moon.
Yes, it will all be interconnected. Yes. So, it doesn't state specifically that this is using 5G, but I'm sure that the 5G technologies are involved. So, but also in terms
of... Shoot, this might be 6 or 7G, as far as we know.
True. And then the next step we will be looking at is quantum communication, quantum transmission. And so that's a whole nother ballgame. So once again, these, you know, kind of extraordinarily advanced technology that China is investing and developing, they're really, you know, kind of the next generation of, you know, scientific mm-hmm. breakthroughs. China is on the leading or cutting edge of that. And of course, you know, the U.S. and NATO and the Atlantic Council want to cut this down to size.
There's an article that I read. We talked about this yesterday, but the way that this thing was framed, it seemed a little odd to me. The article, Beijing offers dialogue with NATO after alliance identifies China as threat. It says on Tuesday, China said it hopes to engage in dialogue with NATO after news of a new report from the alliance that identifies China as an emerging threat. The context of this to me was, oh, China's shaking in their boots, and now that NATO has identified them as a threat, now China wants to come to the table and talk. When my assessment of this was really more, China said, well, okay, if you see me that way, fine. And if you all want to talk, fine. If you don't, fine. We'll party with you and we'll party without you.
Absolutely. Yes, that's their approach. They want to engage. And as you pointed out yesterday, they want mutual, beneficial, win-win relationships with all countries that are interested. So they're extending the olive branch, and they're saying that, you know, China advocates common values for all mankind, peace. You know, who doesn't want peace? Development.
The United States.
I wasn't going to go there, but yes, you pointed that out. Yes.
Oh, okay.
So they want these fundamental values, but NATO has said that, you know, China doesn't share the values of NATO. Well, we can identify certain NATO values like preemptive and aggressive war of invasion. You know, these is what you know, the international community considers to be the supreme crime. The supreme crime against humanity is a crime against the peace. And NATO has been involved in numerous times in breaching this international understanding, which is why in their document against China, they say that they want to defend an international order based on rules. That's a strange statement to make. We don't need an international order based on rules, because then we have to ask whose rules. Really, what we need is an international order that follows international law, which NATO has broken and China is upholding. That is the key problem. And again, that's the source of friction.
And I don't want people to think that my answer to your question about the United States not wanting peace was trite or disrespectful. Michel Flournoy is the one that talked about full spectrum dominance, And she's the one that wrote about that. She's the one that Joe Biden is looking to put into his cabinet. I'm not making that up. These are the documents they've written. This is what they say. Final point, if you want to respond to that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, Flournoy wrote this up in the Quadrennial Defense Review that was in the early 2000s. This notion of, you know, extreme, aggressive, and total dominance, using all means necessary, including military means, preemptive war. This is the doctrine. This is full spectrum dominance. And if Flournoy is placed in a Biden cabinet, as I said, we all have to buckle up and, you know, wait for, you know, a very, very dangerous ride. These people are, you know, war hawks. These people are extraordinarily dangerous. And we have to watch out for this. But we'll wait and see. It seems like she's hit a little bit of a road bump. They haven't announced her right away.
Biden says he won't kill phase one trade deal with China immediately, this deal that Trump struck, nor take steps to remove tariffs on Chinese exports. Quickly, your thoughts on this statement from Joe Biden?
It's a very confused statement. I mean, the trade agreement that Trump engaged in, or really trade war, was a kind of a proxy for the Trans-Pacific Partnership that he took down. The TPP was to isolate China. Trump decided that he was going to go toe-to-toe, one-on-one with China, and he did this by imposing sanctions and forcing these very punitive trade agreements. China's response was to create a double circulation economy so that it's less reliant on trade. But more than that, it was a neo-mercantilist approach that actually was hurting the U.S. more than it was hurting China. And one of the key aspects of this, which the U.S. was trying to impose on China, was they wanted it to take down or dismantle its state-owned enterprises, which formed the core of its economic system. This is socialism with Chinese characteristics, with a market. And so they wanted to change structurally China. China refused to do that. And ever since then, they've claimed that it's unfair. And it looks like Biden will, if he continues this, he'll be going down, you know, the same bad path that Trump did. So I think they need to reconsider this.
And just quickly, we have just about a minute left. I want you to reiterate the point. The United States basically wants China to change its economic structure to
exactly
match the failing capitalist structure of the United States.
Yes, exactly. So that's the core contradiction. The U.S. has always argued that the Chinese system is doomed to fail and that it has to take on a U.S. neoliberal capitalist structure. At the same time, the contradiction is that they have said that China must change because it has an unfair advantage against, Western capitalist states. So there's the contradiction. It wants it to change at the same time that says if it doesn't change, it will collapse automatically by itself. But it knows in its heart of hearts that it is losing hands down to the Chinese system, the kind of planned market socialism. And therefore, they want China. They want to strong arm China into changing, and Chinese won't.
KJ No, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis. Looking forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. Dr. Wilmer Leon, I'm your host. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Attorney General Barr says there's no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the election. His comments contradict President Trump, who is pressing forward with other legal challenges. What does it mean when one of the president's most loyal government officials is stepping away from these baseless challenges? Also, the president has lawsuits? the citizens do as well. For insight into all of this, we turn to our next guests. First, she's a government affairs and public relations specialist and principal of TML Communications, LLC, Teresa Lundy. As always, Teresa, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer. I'm happy to be here.
We're also joined by a man who's known for his investigative reports for BBC, The Guardian, and Rolling Stone. His bestsellers include The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. His new book is How Trump Stole 2020. He's also the author of the ACLU report that was published, Georgia Voter Roll Purge Errors, Greg Pallast. As always, Greg, welcome back.
Glad to be with you again, Doctor.
So let's start with you, Teresa. The president, along with Rudy Giuliani or Rudy Giuliani, is on this rampage. And now, of all people, the attorney general, Bill Barr, says no fraud here. But Giuliani says, well, the Department of Justice just hasn't seen our evidence. I would have thought if they had actually come up with evidence, the DOJ is the first stop on the metro line that you would get off of. Help us out, Teresa.
You're absolutely right. And you know what? William Barr is seeing the writing on the wall, and that writing is saying that his time is coming close to a near ending. And there is no justification of the result. You know, Joe Biden won, and the states have confirmed it, from the governors to the election officials. And I think, you know, just William Barr is saying enough is enough. And I believe when we talk about Rudy Giuliani and the shenanigans he has, you know, portrayed, we are now seeing a rollout of items that seems to be a massive, almost a fraud and almost an investigation that should happen on his end, where we are seeing pardons, you know, allegations of pardons for his family and his children. So it's not like Rudy Giuliani actually has a space to kind of get out of this convolution of delusional, you know, type of, you know, experiences right now, where it's time for him to actually escape, because he still needs something from the president. And the president's like, look, if you want me to give you a pardon, then what you guys need to do is make sure that all the rhetoric that I am continuously doing and I'm continuously spewing, that you guys are either stepping up and sticking with me, or you'll just have to, you know, handle the consequences that'll come down when I'm not in office.
Greg Pallast, Bill Barr is not drinking this glass of Kool-Aid. And you've got not only Rudy Giuliani, but I think Joseph DeGeneva is in the mix as well, calling for people to be taken out and decapitated.
Yeah. Okay. So number one, you have to understand. Yeah, there's these nutcases out there who don't have facts, so but they have weapons, so they're trying to use violence. Let's not get too excited about Bill Barr, who, as a man for all seasons, he's like everyone else, heading for the exits. Look, he how does he make his money? How does the guy pay his rent? He's of counsel to a big firm called Kirkland & Ellis. Kirkland & Ellis and all the other big law firms, as you know, dumped Donald mm-hmm. Trump, the RNC, right, and everyone as clients in these cases. That's because, understand, there is a boycott by the top law student graduates in America saying anyone mm-hmm. that represents Trump on these phony cases, any firm that does that, we will not even interview with those firms. So one of the things that's not really seen by the public is this massive boycott by the top law students in America, which mm-hmm. is forcing these other lawyers all the firms have dumped Trump like, whoa, like totally radioactive. Barr knows if he wants to have a job with Kirkland & Ellis or any of these other big firms, he's radioactive too. He has to do something to at least cleanse his soul and say, even if he hasn't gotten his soul back from the devil, at least he's borrowed it for a few minutes so he can get some post-Trump employment. I mean, it's that cold.
Greg, you had a press conference today announcing a new lawsuit. Barbara Arnwine, who was on earlier, is a plaintiff in the suit. Talk about the suit that you're bringing.
Okay, with Latosha Brown, the founder of Black Voters Matter, Barbara Arnwine, obviously our top voting rights lawyer in America, Columbia Law, and we also have Rainbow Push, the Reverend Jackson, and the C.K. Hoffler, head of the National Bar Association. So that's a heavyweight group of people. We've sued this guy, this Secretary of State. We sued the state of Georgia to return 198,000 voters, Doctor, who were removed illegally from the voter rolls. What does that mean? The ACLU issued that report of mine that you mentioned back in September saying, look, you guys have removed nearly 200,000 voters. By the way, on the grounds that they moved their household, you know, they left. You know, you can't vote in Georgia. If you don't live in Georgia, hey, correct. I agree with that. But they didn't move. Now, how do we know that? Well, the Palast Investigative Fund, my foundation, hired the Postal Service because they said tens of thousands of people had put in change of address forms. Okay, that means that you've moved. You put in your change of address form. According to the U.S. Postal Service, state of Georgia never got this list from them. They said tens of thousands of people on this list never put in change of address form. So you might think that's a small thing. They're saying you said you've moved and you didn't. But this is – I was in the – at down in Georgia. I've been working there investigating racial vote suppression, new forms of Jim Crow trickery for 7 years for Rolling Stone, Al Jazeera, and Salon, et cetera. And what we were finding here is that they used this list from some fly-by-night operator who gave them a phony list, and they loved it because it got rid of the voters that they don't like. But by the way, it violates federal law. Federal law is absolutely stone clear. It says in writing, if you're going to remove people because they moved, you have to check with the post office, and you must use the post office official licensee to get the honest list. I hired the official licensee of the post office. It's called Merkle Corporation. And they said, we don't know where they got this list. These people didn't move. Then we hired all these experts from eBay and Google and Amazon to say, could you please check if these people moved? They said, we've checked 240 databases on every single person. This is a huge, massive computer operation. And no, they haven't moved. And then I went out and met them, people like Martin Luther King's 92-year-old cousin. I was at the polling station when they threw her out, saying that she left Atlanta. And then I went to the house that they said she moved out of. It's phony, and it's ugly, and it's Jim Crow, but instead of using white sheets to get rid of voters of color, they're using spreadsheets, and we're putting an end to it. So we filed today for injunctive relief to get those 198,000 voters back on the rolls before this runoff.
On January 5th, and Teresa Lundy, 196,000 African-Americans or people of color taken off the rolls, but you still have officials saying the election was free, the election was fair, the election was just. As we move into January 5th, runoff for the Senate, it will determine the control of the Senate, very important election, and they still don't want to let these people back on the rolls.
You're right. It's a travesty. 196,000 people taken off the rolls. Just again, it violates our civil rights. And also, if we want to talk about fair and just elections, essentially this was the staple point of what Stacey Abrams was bringing to the table when she, you know, first started her campaign and made huge strides in Georgia. But we need to also make sure we are modeling that same plan of fair and just elections in across every state and every minimum county in these states in order for us to figure out what it takes to move forward as a country. If, again, we cannot have what we are having right now in 2020 where there is, a discrepancy about, you know, who the president is and who won, right? You know, elected officials are, you know, and honestly, in whatever capacity they're in, if they're not in the legislative, they're in county election offices governing the elections, they're getting death threats, right? And their families are, you know, are at risk of being hurt because some of these people are just so focused on the talking points that are literally fake news
or but it's coming from the highest office. So, you know, getting people back on these roles, understanding where the cause of this issue is, should be at the focal point of any new administration. But also, I kind of leave that opportunity also for the states to also do their due diligence to make sure those who are left off the rolls are put back on it. And we need to ensure that, you know, this conversation just doesn't die off in this election, but ensuring that when the next election happens in the next 2 years on a local level, that we actually fix this problem.
Greg, you're filing for injunctive relief, I would assume, because that's the quickest solution that you can work towards, with January 5th being a couple days more than 1 month away. What circuit is the suit being filed in? And based upon the makeup of the circuit and the presidents that appointed the judges to the circuits, what's your probability of victory?
Well, as you know, we got the best, literally the best voting rights legal minds in the nation. We couldn't have a better legal team and also strong plaintiffs. But what's we are related to a suit brought earlier without injunctive release by Stacey Abrams, as you know. And by the way, I want to thank Stacey and Fair Fight, because they covered the cost of our experts in our litigation. So they are very, very helpful. And I should warn you that the Secretary of State of Georgia says that Greg Palast is Stacey Abrams' shill, or his stooge. He's used different words. And, you know, I've been accused of worse things.
I mean, by better people.
She doesn't direct my work. In fact, I didn't even tell the experts. I said, you tell me what the answers are. I don't want, you know, you just go and do the work and give us the results. So, look, we're going before, we believe we'll be able to go before Judge Jones, who was appointed by Barack Obama. And he's considered a really knowledgeable, fair judge. And so we're hoping for injunctive relief, because we just found out that we don't need a big trial. I won my last case against Georgia without even a trial. The judge says there's no trial necessary. Summary judgment, you win. That's it. We think it's cut and dried in the same way. They violated the law. They used the wrong list to remove people who didn't move when they said they moved. It's crazy. Just put them back on before January 5th. I have to tell you one thing that shocked them today.
Oh, wait a minute. Before you say that, let me ask you this. Put them back on the list, put them back on the rolls. But right, I understand. But what if they then want a mail-in ballot? How do you ensure that they get their ballot in time?
Well, this is one of the problems. That's why we're acting for injunctive relief. And by the way, I encourage anyone listening who knows anyone in Georgia, if you're in Georgia, check your registration. Don't be like King's cousin. She voted the same place 50 years, and she had no reason to believe she should check her registration. Do so at SaveMyVote2020.org, SaveMyVote2020.org, because you have till December 7th to re-register if you've been removed. And you don't know if you've been removed. Check, re-register, and if you're not registered, and by the way, if you've moved at all in Georgia, they can't remove you unless you've moved out of your county. I don't care. Make sure that you, if you've had any change of address, re-register right now online, SaveMyVote2020.org. So one of the problems is that once we put people back on, we got to get to them. So we're working with Black Voters Matter. They sent out 98,000 postcards warning people you have to re-register. You've lost your registration. We've just put up we're having a 20 by 60 foot gigantic electronic billboard warning people to check their registration. They may have been purged. Today, Leonardo DiCaprio released two PSAs of ours. One with Rosario Dawson saying, please check your registration. You could have been purged. And okay. One by Zoe Saldana from, Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. And hers is in Spanish. So go to Leonardo DiCaprio or to GregPalast.com.
Okay.
So we have a whole campaign. Warn people.
Got it. And we'll do what we can do here. You know that. Greg Palast, Teresa Lundy, thank you both very much. Really, really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back.
Will do. Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, there's a new security law in France that may have just sparked a George Floyd moment. That's according to the Mint Press article by Dr. Alan McLeod. New laws pushed through by the government of Emmanuel Macron and passed by France's National Assembly, which is akin to the United States House of Representatives, means that sharing images of police brutality and their victims might soon be considered illegal. What does this say about the impact that social unrest in the U.S. is beginning to have internationally? Well, for insight into this, let's turn to our next guest. He's a political scientist, former chair of the political science department at Howard University, internationally recognized expert on international and comparative politics, international poll watcher, author, professor, activist. And I always have to say, folks, you need to get his book, The Black History of the White House. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal read. Dr. Clarence Lussain, as always, Clarence, welcome back.
Thank you.
So Article 24 of France's new national security bill, which now only needs to be ratified by the French Senate, specifically outlaws the publishing and dissemination of images of police that what they consider to be undermine their physical or psychological integrity and is punishable by a fine of up to 45,000 euros and a year in jail. What's going on here in France and why?
So it hasn't become a law yet. And because of the protests and demonstrations, there's some thinking now that they may pull back on it. But what we're seeing is that from conservative and far-right forces, not only in France, but in many other places around the world, their response to the George Floyd uprising in the U.S. has been to try to find a way in which to curtail these efforts to reform police. And so what we see in France is this idea that came from the far right, the conservative forces, that the police need to not be hampered and feel that if they're going to protect and implement the law, that they should not be scrutinized in the ways in which the filming of George Floyd and others in the U.S. Came about. And so that's sort of the underlining part of this bill. It happens in the context, though, of France continually not to address the racial issues and the Islamophobic issues that have existed in the country for quite a while.
I'm very glad that you said that. That was truly going to be the next issue that I raised. I'd like for you to kind of broaden the analysis. You mentioned far right and conservative forces in France and other countries in Europe. If you could broaden the analysis, as you were just indicating, to talk about what's one of the things that's not being really discussed in mainstream media here is that far right and conservative forces over across Europe have been on the rise for quite a while, very similarly to what we're seeing, whether it be the Tea Party in this country, whether it be Trumpism, Make America Great Again, the Tea Party, We Want Our Country Back, and more even aggressive organizations such as the Boogie Boys and some of these other armed so-called militias that we're seeing. So if you could speak to these movements are not only taking place here in the United States, they've been on the march literally across Europe for quite a while.
Going back to the earliest days of the internet, there has been a movement to unite the far right and the neo-Nazi and the neo-fascist forces around the world, but particularly Europe, United States, Australia, countries that are basically considered the white countries of the world. And so there's been a long, long effort to bring all those forces together. And pretty much with the same agenda. And so what we see in France has been the rise of these types of organizations, some of which have contended for political office under the parliamentary structures that exist in a lot of the European countries. It's easier for some of these far right forces to win seats. Others have basically stayed on the outside. But we saw this in the current era with Steve Bannon. When he left the White House, one of the things that he saw as his mission, I guess, was to go around the world building what he called the movement. And this was basically to unite these far-right forces. And it was in France, I think, where he actually said, if they call you a racist, you should be proud of that label. Paraphrasing, but those were essentially the language that he used. And so we've seen this in France for a while. Now, they actually have had, the article mentions about a coming George Floyd moment. But they actually have had one. In 2016, there was a black man named Adama Traore who was on his birthday. I think he was like 19 or 20, something like that, in July, who was caught, who was harassed by the police, and he died from asphyxiation. And as he was dying, he was saying, similarly to George Floyd, I cannot breathe. I cannot breathe. And so his family was not able to get much traction on that at the time. But this year, in part because of the George Floyd uprising and it's metastasizing around the world, the family was able to actually get more attention to that case. And now that case is back in the public light in France. But there have been others as well. So not only has the far right been organizing, but what we're seeing this year, and that's what's generating a lot of the pushback, is that you now got movements in France, in Germany, in the UK, in Spain, all across Europe that are linking themselves to the Black Lives Matter movement and raising all of these issues.
We know the term defund the police here in the United States. That's a great political catchphrase. It hasn't really, in my opinion, there isn't enough meat on the bone from a policy perspective. I mean, there are examples of how that has manifested itself in local legislatures across the country. But in terms of a overall policy, I have not seen enough meat put on that bone. But are we seeing similar defund the police efforts manifesting themselves in France and in other European countries? Or have they not caught up to this yet?
Well, the language has not been defund the police, but there absolutely has been a call for police reform and for ending institutional racism. And so what we've seen in Europe has been the movement to get rid of statues that basically have been put up in to honor colonializers, imperialists, and slave owners, to change the names of buildings and institutions that have been named in honor of these individuals. So there's been a lot of activism similar to here to rewrite the narratives about race in Europe. And so defund the police hasn't really, as far as I can tell, hasn't become a cry, but certainly calling for justice for particularly individuals of color. Some have been people of African descent, but also folks who have been of Asian descent, as well as people from the Muslim communities who have been killed or been otherwise faced some injustice from the police. Those have been the calls. So people have united local calls for situations in their countries in solidarity with calling for justice for Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and so forth.
is Trumpism fanning the flames of this racism in Europe? Is the racism in Europe fanning the flames of Trumpism? Are they mutually exclusive, or is this just the geopolitical racial climate seeking its own level, if that question makes sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. So Trump is unique in a sense in that he is not an ideologue, in part, I think, because he's too lazy to think through ideas. So he kind of functions as a populist more so than anything. Whereas in Europe, there are far-right parties that have very clear, long-standing ideological agendas that include anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, white nationalism. And so those are fairly drawn-out programs that the far-right has that somewhat goes beyond just particular individuals who may come and go, where Trumpism has a certain kind of uniqueness to it that's clearly tied, though, to the Republican Party and its willingness to implement an agenda, Trump's willingness to carry that out, in addition to the corruption and other stuff that goes along with Trumpism. But there, like I said, Steve Bannon tried to, and is continued trying to unite these forces. And I would say not only in Europe, but also in places like Brazil, for example, where one of the sons of President Bolsonaro, who's the president of Brazil, is sort of the designated person representing this movement that Steve Bannon has been trying to implement. So there's a lot that's afoot among these forces, but the challenge has really come strong this year, in part sparked by the movement here that then literally went around the world.
We know that when Steve Bannon left the White House, Brazil was the next place that he landed, and that Bolsonaro was his Trump. And that's how we see the rise of Bolsonaro and the issues that Bolsonaro raised to gain election and dominance in Brazil. I know that's a bit simplistic, but I don't think it's wrong. We have just about 2 minutes left. Are the nationalist ideologies that were so strong in Europe and the racist ideologies now finding common interest in issues in Europe?
Yeah, so they blend. There are some who want to argue that you have these nationalist movements and that they're not racist. But that really is not how it plays out. Even though you may have individuals of color, people of African descent, people from Asia who are part of these movements, like what was the National Front that Marie Le Pen was the head of, for example, had a number of people of African descent sort of front-facing. But when you really kind of scratch underneath, it's really a white nationalist agenda that's really being carried out. And so that's what we see in the UK with the Brexit movement, for example. It was entirely built upon these scare tactics of these colored immigrants, these religions that don't that are against us, was built on that kind of racist reasoning.
Real quick, are there any parallels to what you just articulated to Black Trump supporters that we find in the United States? And I'm not painting all Black Trump supporters with a broad brush, and I'm not even going to put Black Republicans in that group. I see a different mentality between traditional Black Republicans and these new Black Trumpers. Are there any parallels to be drawn in terms of what you just articulated?
Yeah, so I would agree. I think there is a difference. And one question is, when Trump is gone, where do these Black Trump supporters go? Because, again, they're not traditional Republicans. They're not the Colin Powells or the Michael Steels of the world. They were completely tied to these mythologies about Trump. And the Republicans that come after Trump generally won't have any much use for him. What are they going to do with Diamond and Silk and, you know, some of these characters?
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
Right. So, you know, so I think they have nowhere to go, which is a little different than in Europe, where these movements are electoral movements and they actually have incorporated some individuals of color from Italy to Spain to France to other places. You've got some far right black folks, but that's a very different. They're not tied to a particular individual. They have bought into a particular ideology.
Dr. Clarence Lussaint, thank you for what I consider to be some phenomenal analysis. Really, really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. And I hope that you were informed and enlightened. I'm looking forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Please, please continue to practice physical distancing. Wear your masks, wash your hands, cut down on these gatherings. Just stay home and listen to Radio Sputnik. Peace and blessings. We're out.